Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the role of the doctor-patient relationship in healing and why the kind but distant posture of many physicians isn't good enough. We'll spend this hour with Saul J. Wiener, who teaches medicine at the University of Chicago and urges his students to learn how their patients' lives affect their healthcare decisions and whether or not they'll be able to comply with medical advice as directed. We'll talk about the distinction Wiener draws between caring and empathy and why he says caring is better. Our conversation starts after a short break. Has a doctor ever looked through you? I don't mean literally with some kind of scope or x-ray, but sort of beyond you as an individual, intensely focused on whatever medical issues made you a patient at the expense of trying to understand you as a person. Research shows the quality of our relationships to our doctors can affect our health outcomes. And when doctors are guarded or inauthentic in their interactions with patients, they themselves are at risk of burning out. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Saul J. Wiener would like to change that, starting with what young physicians learn during their training. He is professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago, deputy director of the Veterans Health Administration's Center of Innovation for Complex Chronic Healthcare, and co-founder of the Institute for Practice and Provider Performance Improvement. His book is called On Becoming a Healer: The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patients. Saul, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You write that you felt the calling for a career in medicine before you knew very much about what you were getting yourself in for. What were the biggest surprises to you of your time as a student and a medical resident?
Well, I think that everybody who goes into medicine probably watches TV shows and gets this idea of what being a doctor is. From a somewhat artificial and contrived picture of practicing medicine. And I was no exception. I certainly had some real life experience. I'd actually been an EMT. I volunteered on the ski patrol. And so I had some idea of what I was getting into, but it wasn't really until I went for that first interview with a nice suit on and plans to look impressive, that I started to get a sense of what it's like to walk into an actual hospital and smell the disinfectant and seeing people who looked old to me, leaning over in their wheelchairs, and to go behind. I remember the first interview I had was at behind a kitchen with a rheumatologist, and just this sense of, oh my goodness, this sense of otherness. You know, here I was, kind of young, well, you know, dressed in my best suit, and suddenly coming face to face with suffering and illness. And I remember walking out thinking, wow, you know, what have I gotten myself into?
Throughout the book, you stress the importance of curiosity about the people you're caring for. But it doesn't just mean curiosity about their health. You say too many doctors lack curiosity about life circumstances of their patients. Can you tell us the story of Mrs. Dawson, who was seeking weight loss surgery?
Yeah, so Mrs. Dawson was a middle-aged woman. At the time when I met her, I had been staffing the preoperative testing clinic at our hospital. And she, like so many people, had been struggling to lose weight and had sort of been doing all the right things. She had tried a weight loss program. She had, over that period of time, developed some complications, including diabetes and hypertension. She had sought medical care, and eventually got referred to a surgeon for bariatric surgery. Now, one of the challenges in her particular case is that she had had her gallbladder taken out, so she was going to need an open procedure, which means that this could not be done laparoscopically. They would actually have to do an incision, which makes it a tougher procedure. And when I met her in the preoperative testing clinic, a resident I was supervising had just come out, was telling me about Ms. Dawson, and thought this was a pretty straightforward case. She said, you know, this woman looks like she's in great health. We could do an EKG, but basically I think she's good to go. She can have the surgery. And there's not much else to say. And when she and I started walking into the exam room together, the resident mentioned to me somewhat casually that Ms. Dawson was actually looking forward to having the surgery because she would be able to take better care of her son. And so I said, well, what's going on with her son? And the resident looked a little impatient, sort of like, well, you know, I don't know, as if, you know, why would I ask that question? I mean, I'm not taking care of her son. And so when we got in there, I was curious. I said to Ms. Dawson, you know, I understand you're looking forward to this. You want to take better care of your son. What's, you know, what's going on? And basically a whole backstory came out that changed everything. We discovered that she had a son who had advanced muscular dystrophy, that she was caring for him during the last stages of his life. He was in his early 20s. She had a husband who had an alcohol problem, wasn't much use except for the fact that he brought in a disability check. She had a, I think, a 10 or 11-year-old daughter who she was responsible for. So she was really holding the family together. And what she hadn't really thought about was that if she had this surgery, she wouldn't be able to lift her son. She basically bathed him every day. He was highly dependent on her, and that this was probably the most important thing for her at this stage in her life. And in fact, if she had the surgery and she tried to go ahead and do these things, she was putting herself at risk. She could actually open up her wound and have what we call wound dehiscence. And once we had this conversation, she realized that she didn't want the surgery, not at this stage. And so she canceled it. And it's a really important example of why it's so necessary to pick up on these clues. You know, a casual comment like, you know, boy, I'm looking forward to taking better care of my son is so easy to skip over. It's so easy to ignore. And yet it was the key that changed everything during that visit. And I've seen this over and over and over again.
And of course, patients don't necessarily know to express those things to you because they might not realize how much context that would bring to your consultation with them.
Yeah, although what I have found is that patients will drop these clues. They're not aware that they're dropping a clue, but things that are important to them just come out. And they often come out in these really sort of subtle ways. And you know, my experience is that if a patient says something like, you know, I'm looking forward to taking better care of my son, that warrants follow-up. It really warrants saying, you know, gosh, well, you know, what's going on with your son? And I think that part of the way in which we train physicians, unfortunately, pushes us in a different direction. We're sort of very task-focused. It's this idea of, okay, I've got to get through these tasks. The task is this patient's come in for preoperative testing. My job is to figure out what tests I need to order. And once we've done that, we're good to go and we move on to the next patient. And I think there's something about the way in which we're training physicians that unfortunately creates that kind of narrow pathway of thinking.
Sure.
Which, of course, is a problem.
So if a doctor were in training and a patient had come in with a sprained ankle but said, I'm feeling heart palpitations, everybody would understand that warrants follow-up. But young doctors aren't told often about the kind of thing that you're talking about here?
Well, it's as you say, told is one part of it. But I think it's an even broader issue. You know, I almost feel as if they hadn't gone to medical school, they would ask these questions. I think there's something we're doing, which is almost narrowing their vision. You know, if you were with a friend, I would sometimes say this to a medical student or resident. If you were a friend, what would you have done in this situation had they made that comment? And they're like, well, of course I would have asked them, like, what are you talking about? What's going on, man? And I'm like, well, why is it different here? And so I actually think that there's something about the way in which we're training physicians, and it even starts before medical school during those pre-medical years, where it's all about, you know, getting ready for the next multiple choice test or preparing for that organic chemistry exam, and just essentially regurgitating, and then ultimately becoming these task completers. You know, we're told do this, do that. We get really good at it, efficient at it. And I think that's the kind of pathway that leads to this sort of problem.
I can imagine some doctors would worry that too much curiosity, too much follow-up would take more time than they have to spend with each patient. You have found it can actually save time. How does that work?
Well, you know, when I've asked physicians why they don't ask these questions, one of the reasons they often give is, you know, we're busy. We don't have a lot of time and we've got to keep moving on. And yet in a prior book that I wrote called Listening for What Matters, we described years of research where we studied this phenomenon. We actually recorded thousands of visits. And one of the things we discovered is that when physicians pick up on these clues and ask about them, it does not on average lengthen the visit. And you might ask, well, how could that be? And I'll give you an example. Let's suppose a patient comes in and they drop a comment like, you know, boy, it's been tough since I've lost my job. And the reason they're there to see you is because they can't afford some expensive brand name medication that somebody gave them for, you know, their diabetes or their asthma, for instance. Now, if the physician ignores that comment and just sees that this is a patient who has worsening diabetes or worsening asthma, they're going to be thinking, oh, goodness, I need to add more medications. I better do extra tests. I may need to have them see a specialist. That's going to take time. It's going to be expensive. It requires placing all kinds of orders. But imagine instead if they just say, you know, what do you mean it's been tough since you've lost your job? And now they hear a story. They hear that that patient is no longer insured or that their insurance doesn't cover this expensive medication they're on. And now the conversation is about, okay, well, how do we switch this person to a cheaper generic? And once you've done that, you're done. The patient is going to get a care plan that's going to work for them. And you haven't wasted all that time ordering unnecessary tests, referring them to unnecessary consultants, and so on and so forth. So you can see when you start to look at these case by case, how this can actually save time in addition to getting the patient the care that they need simply by following up on these clues.
You were fortunate to have a really important mentor in your life. Can you tell us about how your godfather, who was a doctor himself, reached out to you early in your career?
Yeah, so I was fortunate to know Simon from early childhood, but he became central to me during my first year of medical school when I was really struggling. I'm learning disabled, and so people don't think of doctors as being learning disabled, but some of us are. And my first year of medical school was, for that reason, extremely hard. I was just drowning. I was struggling just to, as I mentioned, it's just sort of one test after another, just cramming us with information, turning us into, you know, as I say, task completers. And, you know, I was miserable and I wasn't sure I was going to make it. And that was a point where my godfather, who was 30 years ahead of me, he was a family physician, also an educator, said, you know, hey, Saul, I think we should start talking. And we started talking regularly. One of the things that he was able to do was to help me in some fundamental ways. First of all, not to define myself by whether I did well on these tests or not. I know that sounds silly, but when that's your life, when you're studying all the time, I think there's this pernicious way in which high achievers, medical students, start to just define themselves, their value, their worth, by how did you do on that test. And that's, unfortunately, the beginning of a destructive pathway, because then it's all about tasks and efficiency and so forth. And then when you move into the clinical years, that efficiency becomes paramount when you're on the wards and you're rounding. And all of a sudden, it's about, can you present this patient, you know, efficiently? Did you order your labs early? Did you get those consultant orders in quickly and efficiently and effectively? And whether you're actually getting to know your patients and forming meaningful relationships is almost kind of, I wouldn't say it's discouraged, but it certainly isn't elevated. It's not a central part of how you're evaluated. And during that time, my godfather was there to remind me of what really matters. You know, why are you in this? You're here to figure out how you, as Saul, and in this case, me, my personality, what brought me to medical school in the first place, can help in the relationships that I form ultimately to make sure that my patients feel known, feel recognized, and are getting the care that they need. And I know that sounds obvious, but I needed somebody there to constantly remind me of that during those years of training. And that's why I was so fortunate to have somebody like that as a mentor.
Am I going too far to say it sounds like reading the book that you counterintuitively feel like maybe your learning disability and the fact that you had to study longer and harder than some of your classmates was a blessing in disguise?
At the time, it didn't feel that way. At the time, I felt so envious of my fellow classmates who just seemed to absorb everything like osmosis. And for me, I actually learned that I couldn't learn the way they did. You know, they would be sitting in the classroom for 6, 7, 8 hours a day, you know, studiously taking notes, soaking it all in. And I couldn't follow a darn thing that people were talking about. So I'd have to leave and go off to a quiet place and just try to figure it out on my own. And in hindsight, there were several things that I gained from that. First of all, it required me to be continuously adaptive in every situation to figure out.
Let me jump in here, Saul, because we have to take a quick break and I want to make sure you have time to finish your point. My guest is Dr. Saul J. Wiener, professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago, author of On Becoming a Healer, The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patient. Doris Boyd. My guest is Dr. Saul J. Wiener, professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and deputy director of the Veterans Health Administration's Center of Innovation for Complex Chronic Healthcare. His new book is On Becoming a Healer, The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patients. Saul, before the break, you were saying one of the things you learned, because it took you longer to absorb the information than some of your classmates, was that you had to go off on your own to study.
Yeah, and I think the benefit of that, as I said at the time, it didn't feel like a benefit at all, but the benefit in hindsight is that it taught me that I needed to figure things out on my own in any given situation, that simply rote mimicry of what everybody else was doing wasn't going to work for me personally. And ultimately, when you become a physician, the ability to think about the bigger picture, and really the bigger picture when you're with a patient is, how can I be helpful to this person in the broadest sense? Not, you know, what steps do I need to do to complete the visit? What tests do I need to order? What diagnosis do I need to arrive at? What, you know, what care plan will essentially meet those diagnostic criteria? You're asking a larger question. You're saying, this person has come to me because they are suffering, they're frightened, they're concerned, they're dealing with a complex life situation. And my job is to try to see how I can be helpful to that person. And it's a broader question. And I think that in a funny way, the fact that I had to kind of figure things out on my own at every stage served me well. The other thing, of course, is that I didn't get a lot of kudos because of my grades. You know, I wasn't somebody who could feel good about myself because I was getting A's, because I certainly wasn't. I was just trying not to flunk out. And so in some sense, I didn't really define myself by being somebody who could just, you know, do great on CHET tests and you know, be very successful when it came to impressing people with my efficiency and so forth. So I think that was another helpful part of it as well.
To your point of having to figure things out for yourself at every stage so that you really understood that you understood them, you have some very interesting thoughts in this book on conformity. What are the pros and cons for conformity for a doctor?
Well, I think there are certain pros to begin with. I think that when a patient comes into the hospital, they need to have a certain consistent level of quality. They need to know that their doctor has mastered certain skills and is highly logical and systematic. If you think about it, when you're admitted as an inpatient, the doctor is going to write orders that are going to determine every step of what happens to you, even what you eat, what activities you can do. And so I think that the sense of knowing that there's a consistency, that your doctor, you can count on them, is valuable and important. And so in that sense, I think conformity has its merits in health training. And there's a certain parallel between that and, say, the way people are trained in the military. There's a certain set of routines that are highly practiced and skills that are acquired, and that's important. I think where it starts to break down is that you also want your physician to be highly curious. And you want them to, I personally want my physician to be somebody who is also personal. What I mean by that is, I don't want a persona. When somebody comes in, if I'm the patient, somebody comes in to see me, the doctor comes in to see me, I want to know who that person is. I want to know that that person is there, not in some sort of scripted role where they're holding me at arm's length. You know, they may be very professional, but they're fundamentally in that white coat and they're scripted. I want a real human connection. And I think that's where individuality becomes paramount. And I do think that the way we train physicians, unfortunately, can go against the harnessing of that individuality. It's a problem that I've seen many patients report, the sense that their doctor is kind of in a scripted role, and that is ultimately not fulfilling for the Actually, it's not fulfilling for the doctor either. I think, as you mentioned at the beginning, doctors are burning out. 50% of physicians report being burned out. And I think part of that is because they are, in a sense, in a scripted role. And if you're spending your whole day holding patients sort of at arm's length, it's ultimately not fulfilling.
What's the difference between an empathetic physician and a caring physician?
Well, you know, people talk about the importance of empathy, and it's become almost a buzzword. And this is something I talked a lot with my mentor about. And we found it useful to distinguish between empathy and caring. Empathy is what you feel. And quite honestly, I don't think that what I feel as a physician in and of itself is particularly useful or helpful to my patient unless it's translated into a useful action. And, you know, I don't actually think of myself as being that empathic. If I'm caring for a patient, for instance, who is much older than me, who is living under conditions of great poverty, who may be highly isolated, I have no idea what it's like to be that person. And I really don't try. And quite honestly, if I were able to put myself in their shoes, it would probably just feel so alien and different. What I'm fundamentally focused on is how can I be helpful to this person? And to me, that's what caring is. Caring is thinking about not what does it mean to feel what this person is feeling, but how fundamentally can I be useful in the time we have together? And I think that if you start to form a human connection across bridges, bridges that are, you know, we can be years apart in age, we can be years apart in culture, but if it's a fundamental human connection, if there's a sense that we're both on in this together, we're both on this life journey together, that can be the beginning of really caring. I think engagement is the beginning of caring, and caring ultimately is about finding out what this person needs that I might be able to offer them in the way of skill or resources or just presence.
All right, let's go to the phone. Kathy is calling from Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for this really nice conversation. I am a nurse practitioner, and so I'm familiar in working in the medical model, but my background, of course, is in nursing, and I would offer that when developing medical curriculum, it might be of value to look at nursing curriculum and specifically at nursing diagnosis, because nursing diagnosis is actually different than medical diagnosis in that we look specifically at social backgrounds, at knowledge deficits. A lot of our diagnoses are worded as deficits in certain life practicalities. And also that the definition of nursing is caring. And so what you're talking about is, you know, right up the alley of merging these two disciplines together.
Thank you so much for your call. Do you have thoughts on that, Saul?
Yeah, I could not agree more. Absolutely. And I've actually been co-teaching a course with a nurse at our hospital for almost 5 years, which is a course for nurses. And it's been focused on this whole idea of context. I actually find that nurses are far ahead of physicians in this area, in my experience. And part of it is for the reason the caller mentions, which is the way in which they're trained and educated. But also, it's just the day-to-day work that they do, that their work requires that they're really hands-on and present in the moment. I think that when you're in the hospital, the nurses that care for you are often far more important to you than anybody else. They're the ones who come moment by moment when you need help and when you need somebody to talk with. And so I think it's much harder to ignore context if you're in that role. I think it's a key point.
You remind us here that healers need to be realists. How does realism play into giving patients the best instructions to give them specifically the best possible outcome for them?
So that's another important point. You know, we talk so much about being altruistic and idealistic in medicine. And yet, I think that there is a double edge to that. I've seen so many people come into medicine with these very high ideals. You see it during the interview process when they're interviewing to get into medical school. They all want to go off to far off lands and you know, cure millions of people and change the world and so on and so forth. And then when they actually get into the world of practicing medicine, they discover that the world doesn't want to change that easily. That, you know, just the day-to-day slog of trying to be helpful to people who have enormous disadvantages, whether it's poverty or a lack of resources or a lack of education. And what can happen is they can start becoming disillusioned and ultimately cynical. And so I've had this concern that idealism can often be a form of really delusion that leads ultimately to cynicism. On the other hand, those who are highly realistic, who go into the healthcare field saying, look, I'm not going to change the world here, but I want to do this for a couple of reasons. One is, I think I'm going to learn something about myself. I think I'm going to find this challenging and interesting. And I think I'm going to make a difference one life at a time, one moment at a time. I think that highly realistic outlook, when I've seen it in young physicians, those are the folks who really stay in for the long haul and are ultimately the ones who form, you know, day-to-day relationships with patients, because in many ways they're fundamentally grounded in reality rather than having this somewhat narcissistic view that they're going to sweep in and, you know, change the world.
Based on what you know about how medical treatment can work, I'm sure it's frustrating, or can be, to encounter a patient who is defined as non-compliant, right? Somebody who for some reason is not following instructions. You tell the story here of a woman called Mrs. Garcia who kept missing her dialysis appointments. Everybody taking care of her knew she needed to be there, but she kept skipping. There was a simple fix possible, but somebody had to ask why she kept missing her appointments.
Yeah, this is all too common. So Ms. Garcia was a woman who had come to the emergency room repeatedly because she had missed her hemodialysis. And what would happen each time is the doctors would sort of do all the biomedical stuff. You know, when you miss your dialysis, it's not good. The electrolytes in your system, in your body, get out of whack, which can be very dangerous. It can put you into dangerous heart arrhythmia. You get fluid overloaded. It's not a good situation. So she would arrive and they would basically do all the right stuff. They'd give her the right medications. They'd monitor her heart. They'd get her dialyzed. She'd go home the next day. And she was sort of labeled this pejorative term, which is frequent flyer. Hmm. These are patients who just keep coming back to the emergency room and they're considered, quote, non-compliant. And it wasn't, I think, until the fourth or fifth visit, I think it was the fourth visit, that a medical student actually, and she was Spanish speaking, which I think had been part of the issue, got an interpreter and started chatting with her. And again, here was a backstory. This was a woman who was responsible for a grandchild who had his own medical problems. He was, I think, 10 or 12 years old. She lived in a pretty happy family environment with a bunch of other family members who were busy working. It was a Latina family. And they were all basically doing their best, but this woman found herself having to make difficult choices when her grandson needed care about whether to miss her dialysis and bring him in or whether to put him in second place. And she prioritized his needs as a good grandmother would. And that was landing her in the ER. Now, once that story came out, we got a social worker involved and they simply arranged for her to have her dialysis at the same site, that at the same facility where her grandson got care. And once that simple change was made, she never came back to the ER again and she never missed dialysis. And the question we have to ask ourselves is why did they just keep saying non-compliant, and nobody asked her, why do you keep missing your dialysis?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go back to the phones. Liz is calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Dr. Wino. There is an aspect of healing that encompasses the patient's psychosocial life that may not be recognized or taught in Western medicine. For instance, there's a discipline, the psychology of health, which demonstrates there's a correlation with behavior attitudes in breast cancer patients, that women with multiple caregiving roles and depression, with untreated trauma, with the inability to speak up, correlate with higher rates of breast cancer, and that any form of psychological intervention post-diagnosis reduces their rates of breast cancer recurrences and reduces their morbidity from any cause.
Well, Liz, thank you for calling. Is there something you hear that you want to follow up on, Saul?
Yeah, I think what she's saying, which I think is true, is that just another reason she's giving why this is so important, which is that if you don't pick up on these psychosocial issues and you just focus on the narrow technical issues, it actually hurts patients in physiologic ways, in addition to the problems that I'd already mentioned, which is that you end up with care plans that don't work. And we've seen that with some of the cases we've just discussed.
Do you eliminate or reduce the temptation that patients might have to lie to you and tell you that they've been doing everything as instructed if you leave room for them to be honest? I mean, how do you make that relationship possible?
Well, I think now you're getting to the key issue of judgmentalism, which is another chapter in the book, which is that unfortunately physicians can often be judgmental. For example, just calling somebody non-compliant rather than finding out why they are showing up in the ER repeatedly, is a form of judgmentalism. It's sort of assuming that that person just has a bad attitude, that they're not looking out for themselves, rather than just having an open mind and saying, gosh, I wonder, this is curious, why would a sensible person do something like this, and asking them, and then discovering that there's actually a sensible reason. So I think that if physicians can get over this issue of being judgmental, it is very liberating for patients, because now patients can feel much more open, can speak much more openly about what they're dealing with without this fear that somehow they're going to be judged because they're now admitting that they're not taking their medicines for whatever reason. And I think that that's just another reason why this whole issue of judgmentalism is important, not just from the standpoint of the way the physician formulates their questions, but from the standpoint of how the patient feels when they're trying to figure out if they can be honest and open with their doctor.
You also say doctors shouldn't be too judgmental of themselves, too self-critical. Can you talk about why that would hurt your ability to do your best work?
Yeah, you know, I think people who go into medicine are hyper self-critical. And, you know, there's some positives with that. I think, you know, there's this kind of perfectionism. When you enter medicine, the folks who choose to do that are really hardworking. They want to learn things correctly. And when they don't do well on a test, they can be hyper self-critical. And I think one of the problems with that is just that tendency to be judgmental will spill over. And by the way, I don't think it's particularly useful when medical students beat themselves up over the fact that they didn't do as well as they liked on a test. But I think it also has a pernicious effect ultimately on the way in which they may think about other people, including patients. So I do think that there is a direct connection between sort of being judgy of yourself and being judgy of others as well. And that's just a key variable in making decisions about patient care.
Dr. Saul J. Wiener is professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's got a new book out called On Becoming a Healer, The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patients. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Saul J. Wiener, Deputy Director of the Veterans Health Administration Center of Innovation for Complex Chronic Healthcare and Professor of Medicine, Pediatrics, and Medical Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His new book is On Becoming a Healer, The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patients. Saul, you have found that to engage consistently throughout your years of practicing medicine, you've also needed to examine your relationships in your personal life and sort of understand the importance of appropriate boundaries. What is boundary clarity, and how does it work, and what does it have to do with you being a good doctor?
Well, I think it's a core concept, and perhaps the core concept of the book, and yet it's not an easy one to explain. And so I worked hard to try to come up with ways of conceptualizing it that I think most people can understand. Here's an example that I think most people can relate to. Let's suppose you're trying to decide what you want to do with your life, and you decide to talk to your parent about it, your mother, your father, for instance. And that person, you know, let's suppose you've dreamed of going into theater, and you want to become a successful artist or performer. Now, your mother or your father are trying to talk you out of that because they think that you're never going to make enough money to live on. And, you know, your dad has a law practice. He'd like you to join that practice someday. That interaction is going to lack boundary clarity. What I mean by that is that, you know, your parents are loving, but they have an agenda. And boundary clarity is when you feel like you can talk to somebody and they don't have any agenda other than to be helpful to you. And so in the doctor-patient encounter, it's critical that when patients are talking with their physician, that they can feel comfortable that physician doesn't have any other agenda. And this can get complicated when there's strong emotion. So for instance, a patient may be angry. They may be angry because they waited a long time to get in. They may be angry because they're upset about their diagnosis, and they may vent that on their physician. Now, it's not intended to be hurtful, but the physician who takes it personally is a physician who has problems with boundary clarity. The physician who understands that this has nothing to do with them, that this is a patient who is frightened, who is anxious, who is angry, and that really that anger is just information that the physician needs to process and respond to in a way that will ultimately be helpful. That is boundary clarity. And I think that developing boundary clarity does not come easily. It's very easy for us to take things personally or to intrude our agenda into interactions with others. This is just as important in our personal life and our professional life. So I spend a good deal of time in the book trying to give examples of what it means to have boundary clarity and why it is such an essential component to being an effective physician, to being willing to engage. If you don't have it, you're going to be at risk of getting into conflicts with your patients. You're going to be at risk of holding them at arm's length. And as you mentioned, developing that quality of being clear about boundaries can also make you a terrific parent, a terrific friend. It's part of who you are as a person.
If you're working actively to not hold your patients at arm's length, have you ever struggled to leave work at work when you get home?
You know, I think that there is a lot of misconceptions about that. We talk about the importance of, you know, having boundaries with your patients so that you don't bring them, you know, don't bring their issues home. And I actually think it's the other way around. I think that if you have fulfilling, nourishing interactions with patients, meaning that the focus is always on them, it's always on their well-being. You're not getting together with your patients in the same way you're getting together with a friend. The focus is on being helpful to that person. But if in other respects you are engaged, you recognize that this is a fully personal connection, that you have a clear sense of boundaries, then you get a certain joy in your work. And when you walk out that door and go home, you're fulfilled. Now, if you have that sense of joy and you feel a sense of clarity about who you are, that's also going to serve you well when you walk in the door.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Sharon calling from Euless, Texas. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. Dr. Wiener, I have a question about, you talk about boundaries and judgment and a lot of things that make sense to me. Is there also a factor in different patients' communication styles where some patients will hold back and be reticent and you don't get the backstory? Other patients will be very forthright, maybe because of anxiety. And I've had an issue myself where I recently had to have back surgery and then I had problems with my knee at the same time. So I went into my primary care doctor to get clearance for my knee surgery, and my doctor did ask the question, why are you doing this? And I reacted kind of anxiously. Well, I'm only 60 and I feel like I'm 80 years old. And I think that shut her down. And after she left the room, I realized that, oh, she was just trying to dig down and find out and probably want to discuss with me the effects of having two surgeries close together. So I asked the nurse, can I talk to my doctor another minute and ask for her opinion? And my doctor didn't want to give it. I think she had already shut down.
Well, Sharon, I'm sorry that happened to you. Thank you for calling and sharing that story. Saul, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a wonderful example. I mean, I'm sorry for the challenges that she's had, but it's a really good example of some of the more nuanced part of this relationship between doctor and patient. And I have a few thoughts I'd like to share. First of all, I think it was great that she asked if she could speak with her physician again. And I think it was unfortunate that she didn't get that opportunity, if I follow correctly. And I think that from the standpoint of the physician, we need to understand that going to the doctor is really frightening. And disorienting. You know, we're in our space. That's where we spend all our time as doctors. But for patients, it's really frightening and difficult, and they feel like they don't have a lot of time. And I think that the advice I would give to the physician is ask a follow-up question. If you've asked a question and the explanation or the response you've gotten from your patient doesn't quite add up, if you feel like you don't have the whole story, ask another question and just say, you know, I'm not sure I follow. Can you clarify that? Would you like to tell me more? And it seems like her physician took the first step, but not the second step. And ultimately, that led to a less than fulfilling and ideal encounter.
It seems natural, if not ideal, for doctors who see their patients suffering in multiple ways to kind of focus on the medical stuff that they're supposed to be in charge of. How have you learned to resist that urge to kind of retreat from experiencing suffering with someone else?
I think that when I walk into a patient's room, I'm thinking in terms of how can I be helpful to this person in the broadest sense? And I think of my medical training as just sort of a little toolkit that I'm carrying in with me that I'm going to dip into. And I realize a person has come to meet with me because I have that toolkit. But really, I'm just walking in there to say, gosh, how can I help you? What's on your mind? What's important to you? And I also make it clear how much time we have. The bean counters have only given you 15 minutes of my time or 20 minutes of my time, but let's figure out what's important. And I think that just that very common sense approach has served me well. And by being open about it, it sort of sending a message to the patient that this visit is for them. And I don't know if I fully answered your question, but I found that framework has been essential to every visit.
I have never been in medical school and don't have experience with this except based on what I've read. Why does it seem that medical training is set up like a hazing exercise where you have young doctors working these punishingly long shifts, at least on TV and in the movies, they're subject to kind of humiliation by their supervisors if they make a mistake during rounds. What is the advantage of that?
Well, I don't think there's any advantage, and I think it's a huge problem. I think that it has to do with power dynamics, and this is just my intuition. For instance, when you show up in medical school, essentially your time is controlled by the people in charge of the medical school curriculum. They can take up every moment of your day by just having you memorize insane amounts of information that you're going to forget and will probably never use. And I think that's a form of control. And authority, and it's a way of putting you in your place. And also, it takes away from your sense of well-being. Why organizations, whether it's the military or the healthcare system, use that as a tool of social control, I don't know. I think there might be some value in the military when you're trying to prepare people for battle, but I just don't see the value in preparing people to become healers.
Is it changing anywhere?
Well, I think it is. When I was in residency, there were no work duty limits. We worked 110 hours a week often. There was just no limit. And then around, almost 20 years ago, Congress actually stepped in and said, this is ridiculous. And it's not safe. You can't have doctors who haven't slept for 2 days. And they set an 80-hour work week. And interestingly, it was the medical profession that protested, which was just ridiculous. Who would ever think that would happen? Ultimately, the science was behind it. Extreme fatigue is not safe for patients. You don't want a doctor who hasn't slept. But it's been a gradual, slow process. Clearly, there has been improvement and steps in the right direction. But I still think we have a long way to go in terms of the culture itself.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, back to the phones now. We have Carol calling from San Antonio. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I was calling because I'm what's called a standardized patient at UTSA in health sciences, and we work with the medical students there. And it has become a very important part of their curriculum to understand what people in poverty go through just to accomplish everyday things and how some of these issues might be impeding their access to medical care and why they haven't filled the prescription or shown up to get their insulin picked up or whatever that might be. So they actually even do poverty simulations where medical students have to jump through the kind of hoops that an everyday person might have to go through just to get a bus ticket so they could go and get the money so that they could go and get the prescription, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Carol. Have you heard about that in other training facilities as well, Saul?
Yes, I'm glad that the caller brought that up and that she has worked as a standardized patient. I've actually spent much of my career working with standardized patients myself. Actually, my earlier book deals extensively with my experience with standardized patients. They're invaluable for training medical students and residents. And actually, one of the things that I've done over the years is actually train them to go unannounced into physician practices. And we've done a lot of research with that where we've gotten physicians, hundreds of them actually, to agree to not know when they're seeing a fake patient. And we train the actors to portray, as you say, poverty, life complications, I mentioned before, you know, we actually trained an actor to go into practices and say, you know, boy, it's been tough since I've lost my job, and to be on an expensive brand name inhaler. We sent two actors to over 100 practices to do that, and the physicians agreed to not know when they were seeing a fake patient. And then we gave them feedback on based on that experience. So I do think it's an invaluable tool, both for studying what's really happening during the doctor-patient encounter, and also for giving feedback in real life, as well as in the clinical training setting.
At this moment, when doctors and hospitals all over the country and all over the world are, in some cases, stretched really thin by the COVID-19 outbreak, in some cases just concerned that they may see infectious patients, you know, we have everybody sort of tired from the extra work, also gowned up and gloved up and masked up for their own safety and that of patients. But I wonder if you have thoughts for doctors who find themselves find a sort of paucity in the relationship that they can have with their patients when all this important protective gear is between them and this other human being.
Well, I can speak personally here because I'm also a care provider on the front line these days, and I have found it to be very challenging. You know, we are wearing a lot of protective gear. Actually, I would have to say for me, and I'm only speaking personally here, what I find most disconcerting is that it's hard to be relaxed with a patient when you're afraid of getting sick yourself. Mm-hmm. And so there's a desire to keep a distance, a physical distance, and to try to get out of there as quickly as you can. I also do telehealth these days, where I make phone calls to patients and I can see them over video remotely. I've actually found that to be much more positive because, you know, I'm relaxed. I'm not afraid of getting sick myself. And so I'm sort of my usual self in that situation. So I haven't found that it's just the protective gear that creates the barrier. It's the real fear that we as providers have. You know, how can you be comfortable sitting close to a patient when you're worried that you're going to get sick for every moment you spend together? And I think that's just a tremendously unfortunate part of what we're going through these days.
And there's really, at the moment, no way around that, is there?
No, there really isn't. Although I will say that when we're able to have conversations remotely with patients, it does. I know it sounds paradoxical because typically you think of intimacy as being physically together. But when you don't have that, I would say the second best is to be able to be in a relaxed conversation with somebody virtually when you're not worried about getting sick yourself.
Dr. Saul J. Wiener is professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago, deputy director of the Veterans Health Administration's Center of Innovation for Complex Chronic Healthcare, and co-founder of the Institute for Practice and Provider Performance Improvement. His new book is On Becoming a Healer, The Journey from Patient Care to Caring About Your Patients. Saul, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. We hope that you'll subscribe to the Think podcast. It's free wherever you get your podcasts, and you can find it by searching for KERA Think. You can also listen on our website at any time. That's think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.